Welcome to BIT, the Brilliant Investment Thinkers podcast. Where the Inside Network, a community of financial professionals, come together to discuss the things that matter in advice, investing, and life. Covering everything from growing businesses to regulation and investing. Our guests will reflect on a lifetime in financial services, sharing their stories, knowledge, and experience. And now, here's your podcast.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tan Sharp, Managing Editor at The Inside Network. Today's pod is all about equities and portfolio construction in the modern era, which I'm sure is a vastly different game to what it has been in the past. While the basic tenets of investing remain the same, we still want to select companies that are undervalued with an acceptable degree of risk, the mechanisms around buying stocks are vastly different than they were 10, 15, even 20 years ago. Now, managed accounts have clearly changed the game, especially for financial advisors, with the job of asset allocation largely swallowed up by investment committees who weave their magic on model portfolios that sit on investment platforms which look nothing like the interface you'd see on a master trust back in 2005, for example. Along with the advent and popularization of managed accounts, ETFs have revolutionized the industry and provided low-cost alternatives to both direct investing and active management. And then, of course, you have ESG, which seems to have gone off the boil a bit lately, but remains core to most people's investment mindset. You also have robo-investing with providers like StockSpot and SixSpark offering consumers new ways to get into the market. Although, as we saw, of course, quite recently, SixSpark went bust. So that shows that that sector on its own has a few challenges. But across all these changes you've seen across investing and the way we invest and the markets themselves, we've also had an epic all-time bull run that has thus far been impervious to decline, with even a pandemic only really giving a temporary blip there. Now, to discuss all these things, I've brought in someone who not only knows the equities arena far better than I, but someone who's never short of an opinion, SQM Research's Paul Saliba. Paul, good morning to you.
Good morning. How are we going?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Now, Paul, perhaps you could kick off by telling us about your professional journey and your path to SQM. And I'll note, of course, that you've only got your feet under the desk there recently. You've been there about 3 months, is that right?
A month and a half. So, Yes, not very long at all. So my background is fund management research and equity portfolio management and research. So I was previously at AMP as a senior manager running equity model portfolios and equity portfolio SMAs. And before that, IOOF, where I was head of equities and portfolio construction. So that was managed accounts, it was model portfolios, it was direct equities, it was diversified risk, profile-based portfolios, fund of fund, and a little bit of, you know, kind of objective-based investing. So that has been my career that in the last sort of decade, and before that was more of the same in different sort of businesses and different opportunities, some more on the analytics side and some more on the investing side.
Yeah, so really covering the institutional advice investment markets there over the past few years.
Yeah, so certainly what most of the products and solutions and the research that I've done has gone into the intermediated space, financial advisors. Back in the early 2000s, I did a little bit of work in direct equities that went to retail market and in funds management that went to the retail market. So it's a varied experience. Throw in that, I've also been a responsible manager on a variety of AFSLs, including at AMP and IOOF previously.
Very good. So a minute ago, I mentioned the rise of managed accounts, Paul, and model portfolios. How has this fundamentally changed investing?
I think from the investor's perspective, you've got a professionalisation of the investment management. From investment manager's perspective, you've got different gatekeepers. And so I think model portfolios were the first step in, I suppose, businesses trying to make the outcomes of clients more consistent, giving the same outcome to the same sort of client if you do it by risk profile or if they've got similar return objectives. So one of the problems traditionally is advisors would put a whole lot of recommendations to a client today, and then in 3 months' time, a client with similar attributes, similar either risk tolerance or similar objectives in terms of return would get a somewhat different portfolio based on what the advisor was thinking then. And so the first step in making that better for clients and more efficient for the business was model portfolios. But that still has the problems of when do you implement, when do you provide the advice to the client. Managed accounts, which I think really started from the broking fraternity of kind of annualised income and moving away from the brokerage model of income and delivering equity portfolios to their clients that are managed internally, usually by the broker in question, but maybe by the house itself. And this took its legs from that space and then moved into fund-to-fund diversified portfolios. Some of the benefits of managed accounts, direct ownership and all that sort of thing don't really apply when you have fund-to-funds, but there's still a whole lot of benefits in fund-to-fund investing for the client, particularly around fairness, which is one of the three tenets of an AFSL, is fairness is one of those three key pillars of how advice is meant to be provided. And managed accounts deliver that fairness in that everyone has a change implemented at the same time. Everyone has the same change. You don't have clients being shifted this month versus some clients next month or in 3 or 4 or 5 months' time as traditional advice would have. And so I think managed accounts solve that problem, that you're not the last client to get the phone call from your advisor saying, hey, we've decided that we want to get out of X fund or X stock and move into an alternative, and here is the recommendation and why. That is disadvantageous, or maybe fortuitously it is advantageous to that client who's at the end of the list because of how much fun they have or how new they are to the business or how whatever the case may be. So I think there's a lot of advantage to managed accounts, and certainly the industry sees the benefit on their side as well in terms of a more efficient business, a better way for them to deliver advice, less documentation that has to be transferred to the client to sign off and the delays and issues around that.
Yeah, certainly the efficiencies are pretty plain to see. I think that's a given. Also the risk, I think the way it dials down the risk because you can do everything at once. And I remember in the advice group that I was in transferring to managed accounts and explaining the reasons for it to clients and really extolling the virtues of being able to move quickly if Trump got into power and had his finger on the button, and that probably dates my period in advice. That's when Trump was being elected. But that really kind of gives you an idea of the potential of managed accounts and the benefits there. And there are some negatives as well, and you can speak to the homogeneity of investments and what it does, but that's a whole different discussion. Are there any other downsides to managed accounts that you've come across?
Yeah, look, there's probably in a fund-to-fund environment, if you go to any balanced fund, growth fund, where it's in a fund, things like hedging currency, well, they'll do that with futures contracts that they can roll over. They don't have to transact underlying assets. And they can move those hedges fairly expeditiously. They can do it easily and at low cost. In a SMA that sits on a platform, whoever it is, to move from unhedged to hedged or vice versa, you really have to exit a fund and buy another fund that's hedged. You might buy the exact same manager who has the hedged and unhedged versions, and there are certain leakages to doing that. There's out of the market, there is crossing the spread of the funds. And so that is a clear disadvantage to clients in a SMA relative to a balanced fund. Some of the tax benefits that are talked about, they are true, but they have less impact if you own fund of funds. Certainly you have the cost basis of the fund, and whatever flows through from the fund in terms of franking credits, dividends, etc., still flow through to you. And when you sell at your cost base. But that's true when you own a fund outside an SMA. It's truly in the equities and direct investments where that makes a difference, because the fund may realise a lot of capital gains in a particular period, and you still will get that distribution of gains in that period. So that benefit, that tax benefit that is talked about quite a lot, doesn't really apply necessarily in fund-to-fund investing.
Yeah, and I noticed you use the term fund-to-funds when you're talking about model portfolios, which is a reminder that there's an extra layer of management there as well that sometimes manifests itself in a separate managed account fee that licensees charge which could be construed as a negative as well.
Yeah, that's true. So depending on who runs the managed account, is likely to be an investment management fee for the managed account, and then whatever fees apply to the underlying assets. Obviously, if they're managed funds and unit trusts and so forth, there's management fees underneath. And so there is potentially an extra layer of fees, but there is actually a level of work being done that if you went into a diversified fund, you probably have levels of fees and it mightn't be as great. And I think there is some risk that the fee is a little higher in an SMA, but then you have the benefit of owning the assets. You know what you own.
Sure.
You can see all the lines. So there are some, and not everything is only beneficial. There are always some negatives to any change in structure and doing things differently. It seems to be at the moment, weight of numbers suggests that the benefits are probably outweighing what you lose or what you give up or the costs that come with having that different structure.
Yeah,
not everyone agrees with that. I do know there are businesses out there that actually adamant that they don't want to have their clients in managed accounts.
Indeed. I've spoken to a few advisors over the year, not many, it's a minority, that don't believe in them. And I think you're right that the sort of the weight of numbers there is that the efficiencies and the risk factors really kind of put it in the positive camp. Now, you've been involved in putting those kind of models together in previous roles, and now you're on the research side at SQM. So how does SQM assess models? Is it a combination of performance, management, governance? What are the kind of metrics that you look at when you're assessing these model portfolios?
So at SQM Research, we assess investment products. They might be through a PDS, they might be through an information memorandum, they might be managed funds, unit trusts, they might be SMA managed accounts. We have an extensive scoring system of 37 individual factors. They, at the top level, are your normal kind of assessment criteria, your governance and business, the people, the product features, risk and return, philosophy, process, and then portfolio construction. So we look at all of those things and all of the 37 individual factors for all products that we assess, regardless of whether it's an SMA or not. So an SMA that is direct equities or direct investments, the RFI, request for information that goes to the manager, might be a little bit different to a multi-asset fund of funds. But a multi-asset fund of fund, we give that to a manager of fund of funds, be it platforms or whoever else is running in a unit trust fund of funds. We give that same RFI to a SMA manager. We have qualitative RFI. So there's two parts to the RFI. There's a whole lot of qualitative about the process, the system, the philosophy, the people, all of those things that I mentioned. And then there's the quantitative data of allocation, attribution, performance, risk metrics, all of that sort of stuff, some of which we calculate off the back of the content provided by the manager. So we blend qualitative and quantitative factors.
Okay, including fees in the...
Your fees are part of the assessment, yep. Absolutely. And we look at that and comment to that if it might be a little excessive, if it's highly competitive, whatever the case may be, we will comment to that. And we do assess against both benchmarks that the manager might propose or that we think are appropriate and against what we think is a sensible peer group. And so we refine the peer group, so that is not just off the system. We actively look at the peer group and say, yes, that should this manager or this alternative solution should or should not be part of the benchmark of this manager. So we're looking at both relative returns to benchmark and relative returns to a peer group, and the same with the cost.
Okay, understood. On ETFs, Paul, I asked about downsides, and obviously there's a whole host of benefits to ETFs and we could extol their virtues all day, but I'm interested in some of the negatives about ETFs. I mean, I guess when it comes to ETFs, it's all in the strategic asset allocation, right?
Yeah, the ETF is critically determined by the underlying assets and the manager of the assets. Now, passive ETF obviously is driven passively and probably aside from any underlying liquidity. Bear in mind that liquidity really is about the underlying assets. With market makers and market participants and the creation of units and so forth, the process of an ETF, and you can talk to the ETF providers for more details on this, at the end of the day, the supply and demand is driven by the underlying assets that are held. So if you have a significant order to buy or to sell, that can usually be facilitated market makers and market participants. And so that there aren't many units on screen to buy or sell is not really the liquidity that you should think of when dealing in ETFs. So what an ETF, to me, there's many benefits and not a lot of negatives. In fact, when I think of LICs and LITs, the prevalence of premiums and discounts, I mean, that is the old product of the 80s and 90s that is now in many ways superseded by a ETF. You can do the same things. I suppose from a manager's perspective, it's not captured capital, so there is some issues around management because capitals flow in and out, similar to a managed fund. So there are some issues, particularly ETFs in less liquid spaces and less liquid asset classes. Sure. But otherwise, I don't really see a whole lot of negative, other than, you know, and I think the negatives that are out there are probably a little bit overstated. We're now seeing that prevalence of active ETFs coming to market.
Yeah.
Traditionally, they were all passive in some way, shape or form. They might have been very sector or asset specific, oil, energy, commodities, currencies, particular parts of the equity markets. That might traditionally be where it's been, away from your broad S&P 500 global indices, global fixed income, Aussie equities, ASX 200 or 300. But now we're starting to see Magellan's and others, Fidante, Perennial, they're all these groups are bringing active funds, which there's a little bit of a different dynamic because you can't necessarily look at the holdings in real time in the same way as you can with a passive fund.
Yep.
But you couldn't with the active unlisted fund anyway. And you didn't buy it to know exactly what the holdings are today. You're buying it for their capability and their investment expertise and their ability to add the alpha, manage the risk, whatever the case may be. And so to me, an ETF brings that to the table much better than LIC, LIT, with not really a lot of significant downside, other than obviously the markets that they're in and all the risks that come with whatever they're investing in.
Yeah, I guess, you know, the main one is that you are beholden to the market, and any large kind of market downturn would affect the entire ETF market, it feels like, given that there's such broad investment in that area. But as you said, there's now options to mitigate that to a certain extent with some active elements there as well.
Sure.
Without bringing the fees up too high. I want to switch on to ESG now, Paul. The movement seems to have lost a bit of momentum recently, with greenwashing really gaining prevalence. And I would say that term is probably trending more so than sustainability. Are ESG-themed funds a tougher sell now? Not only because of some of that negative press, but also because ESG considerations are quite often baked into to most investments out there.
Yeah, they are more and more baked in, but perhaps not to the extent that some people think or some people desire. ESG, I think, has become difficult in terms of flows and selling ESG, partly because of performance. You know, there is an inherent tilt towards growth assets that are growing, that are perhaps a little earlier phase in their business cycle. Certainly, perhaps also tilted towards, in some respects, to mid and smaller companies. But they're also tilted towards more dynamic and growing demand areas of the economy. And I think, yes, there are some challenges there, but that performance, anytime there's weakness in parts of the market's demand slows. That's part of why there is the weakness. The demand stops the price pressure going up and people start to sell a little bit, and that is experienced in the underlying market and reflected in the funds that invest in this space. So that is understood. I think the opportunity there is still significant from an investment perspective. So ignoring the fact that some days on my suit I have a sustainability UN development goals on my lapel, there are investment thesis that stack up very well in a lot of areas that are ESG related, whether that's renewable energy, better ways of waste management, recycling, glass on windows to insulate buildings, insulation, hopefully in time, environmentally or low emission or no emission concrete and all these sort of things. You know, there is human progress is usually profitable. Now, we know that with the tech boom, there were a whole lot of companies that went bust, but there was a lot of positivity out of that, and out of this there will be a lot of positivity. It's also exploratory, so a lot of companies try things, they bring things to market that may not have long-term life.
Speculative.
Yeah, correct. They're trying to do things, they're trying to push the envelope, they're trying to change things, they're trying to bring new and innovative ways of whatever it is, whether it's in people management, whether it's in waste management, whether it's in the way we produce steel and concrete or electricity, whatever it may be, it's across the whole market. And I think that has usually, and history will show, that has shown to improve our way of life. It's improved our GDP and it's improved profitability and profit and earnings and everything that comes with that. And so that's really capitalism, but it has a focus at the moment and there are some costs and so forth to that. And some people are very aware of that and concerned that it's a woke movement and all these sorts of things. But I think if you look at a lot of fundamentals of these businesses, those that have the longevity that are starting to, you know, be demonstrated in profitability and so forth, there is opportunity there even if you're not after the ESG piece from your own philosophical standpoint.
Sure. Yeah, you're right. It's the sustainable companies out there are sort of starting to mature. You know, the early point that you made about we're sort of at the front end of that curve, I would say that we're probably just after that front end, and now you're starting to get more companies out there that investing in the ESG space but have actually matured and become a little bit more stable. So you're absolutely right. It is always a challenge because it is a little bit more speculative, but we're just starting to move up that curve a little bit, which is a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it depends what industry and what space, but there are still earlier industries, and there's certainly, you know, more advanced businesses that have been doing their thing for a long time and profitable and well established.
Yeah. I want to get a little bit topical on markets now, Paul. Equities have performed pretty well in the first half of the year, both here and in major markets abroad, despite, I guess, what you would call some serious global economic headwinds in terms of inflation. Even major tech stocks have recovered pretty well, despite their wobbles. What do you think it'll take for the economic turbulence to filter into real stock market disruption?
Yeah, I think clearly the first thing is a resurgence in inflation. So if there was some sort of resurgence in inflation for whatever reason, I think that would spook markets and drive concern around where interest rates go, and clearly equity markets and markets more generally would react to that. That's probably unlikely. So then it becomes about what are other things that could occur that catches the market by surprise that isn't really part of the current expectations. Markets react poorly to uncertainty. And at the moment, uncertainty has diminished in the market. There is still a question mark about economic recession. And I think if we saw data that showed that we are actually moving into recession, not indicators suggesting recession, but actual data that says we have negative growth in actual growth, not PMIs that are forward-looking, we actually have significant negative growth in revenues and earnings in a bunch of sectors in the market, then I think then markets would react to those signs. And they probably act to early when, you know, the quarterly results show a decline at JB Hi-Fi or Woolworths or Bunnings or whatever the case may be. And clearly those examples I've used are really retail-oriented and really consumer-based because I think that's where the risk is. Obviously, we've had 10, 11 interest rate rises in fairly short time, and the challenge of going from a 2-something mortgage to a nearly 6%, perhaps 6% on your mortgage is a significant impost to whoever has a mortgage. Regardless of how wealthy you are, however big or small your mortgage is, there is perhaps a 2x spend on your mortgage. And so that money, presumably at the moment, is coming from savings, and all the evidence is that, and the savings rate has dropped off quite substantially since COVID, but also the savings we actually had, the banked savings, so the excess of money in cash sitting on offset accounts and those sort of things, that is diminishing. The arrears numbers, and ANZ said that not recently, that the arrears numbers actually still better than what they were before COVID. And so to me, at some time, if that turns in a severe way, then markets would react negatively because then the economy is likely to contract. And I think that could happen domestically, which already started to happen in parts of Europe. And then the question mark is around the US. And the US GDP for the last quarter actually accelerated from the December quarter. So the last lot of results for the March quarter were better than expected and better than the December quarter. So to me, the risk of recession has diminished a little bit. But there's a lot of people still thinking recession. In fact, on LinkedIn just recently, someone put up a survey. I think there were three responses: soft landing, no landing, a recession. And of over 300 respondents, 60% of people suggested that recession for the US is still likely.
That's interesting. I'm starting to, you know, obviously I'm watching the news cycle pretty closely, and I'm just starting to see stories trickle in that are actually running with the narrative that globally there's a recession that never was, that even though we've come close and we've kissed the sky, to use a Jimi Hendrix term, we haven't actually got a recession in most economies. And unless, as you say, there is a sharp turn and inflation starts going back up again and we see more rate rises, we may have got that soft landing. Here's to hoping, at any rate.
Yeah, obviously the concern is, have central banks already gone too far, and do they unwind a little bit, i.e. reduce rates at some stage sooner rather than later, or do they delay too long? So the rates are elevated, people are paying more for their mortgages, businesses are paying more on bank loans and any loans that they roll over, and they can sustain that for a while. And maybe some can sustain it for the long term, that's fine, but there's probably a significant proportion that are hoping or wanting rates to fall, or hoping their situation changes that they can reduce their debt or refinance or whatever it might be. And the concern right now in some quarters is, have they already gone too far at the Fed, the RBA, in Europe, ECB, and in London and elsewhere, yeah, and other places?
It's a fair point and a common concern that the baked-in interest rate rises are still yet to have an effect, which could still have a significant detrimental effect on markets. Without giving too much away, where are you seeing, I should say, pockets of value in the stock market, Paul?
Yeah, in the local market, and probably actually in the US and overseas, small and mid-cap companies, I think quality companies with good ROE, return on assets, and good earnings. The market is elevated, but it's very split between certain sectors and certain stocks, particularly in the US market, really high PEs, if that's one of your measures of value, with a whole bunch of companies that are actually quite low on the PE. And I think it's bifurcated. And I think similarly in Australia, although our Australian market has less breadth than the US market, and so is probably not as drastic in that dispersion, but it's still very dispersed between high PE and low PE companies. And so I think there are, where there's quality of earnings and at the moment the multiples, however you want to measure it, aren't too high, there is a range of areas that are attractive. It probably isn't in consumer discretionary and some of the industrial space and information technology. I mean, information technology, particularly in Australia, pre this pullback and after the big rally on the back of COVID, our market was probably more expensive than most other information technology markets around the world, and probably not the quality, certainly not the quality of what you see in the US, and not the size. And so to me, some of those companies, they might be good businesses. Some of them, they might be good for a while, but maybe not in the long term. I'll leave others to judge that now that I don't manage direct equity portfolios. But
are we saying there that companies like Canva and Atlassian, the big domestic tech stocks, were slightly overvalued in the last few years?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And some of the big names in the US and even, you know, your Xeros and Altiums and other smaller companies, less known companies here in Australia, although they've become well known just because of their market movements. Yeah, they were certainly trading at really stretched multiples that you had to assume a lot went right and nothing went wrong, and then you had to be very optimistic. And so, of course there is Amazons out there in the world where they were on a very high PE 10, 15 years ago, and they've grown into that, and that PE was not indicative of the value that we see today. And there will be 1 in 100, 1 in 500, 1 in 50. I haven't actually analysed those numbers. That will occur again, but to own 50 of them and get the one might statistically work for you, but if you own two of them, and then your odds aren't great. And so to me, yeah, there is a challenge there that you want to be very informed about the company, and even then your information is probably not a lot better than the next guy's, and there's a lot of risk to those sort of prices.
I think the market is really looking at NVIDIA as the only company that has that potential. And I think for NVIDIA to really match the price that it's asking in terms of stock, it needs to perform as well as, say, a Salesforce or a Microsoft over the next 10 years to validate that price.